Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a woman has a constitutionally protected right to have an abortion in the early stages of pregnancy. In 1992, the court upheld Roe, but ruled that states can put limits on abortion, such as requiring women's informed consent and parental notification for minors. In recent years, Republican-controlled state legislatures across the country have accelerated their challenge to Roe v. Wade by passing laws restricting access to abortion. According to a new report by the Guttmacher Institute, over the course of the year, 39 states enacted 141 provisions related to reproductive health and rights, and half of the new provisions, 70 in 22 states, restrict access to abortion services. Earlier this month, the New York Times reported that two clinics in South Texas, which provide abortion and other services, shut their doors, making legal abortion unavailable in the poorest part of the state in the wake of tough new restrictions passed last year by the Texas legislature. There were 44 facilities that performed abortions in Texas in 2011, and after the two closings, there are now 24. When the law is fully implemented in September, that number is expected to drop to just six. So Texas is going from 44 clinics to just six. Lindsay Scheibel is a 20-year-old student at the University of Texas at Austin and founder of Fund Texas Women. It's a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions both in and out of the state. And Lindsay joins us from Austin. Hi, Lindsay. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. And over the past decade, there have been over 10,000 acts of violence reported at abortion clinics. Doctors and clinic workers have been murdered. Clinics have been bombed, burned down, vandalized, and blockaded. And patients are routinely harassed and intimidated. Just last week, All Families Healthcare in Kalispell, Montana, just one of four clinics in the state, which provides comprehensive reproductive health care, including abortions, was broken into and severely damaged by a vandal. The suspect, Zachary Klunt, was arrested in connection with the break-in. He is the son of the board member of Hope Pregnancy Ministries. That's an anti-abortion crisis pregnancy center in Kalispell. Susan Cahill is a physician's assistant and the owner of All Families Healthcare, and she joins us from Kalispell. Hi, Susan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we are also joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check. They're a website providing news, commentary, and analysis on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I want to start off with you, Susan. You run the clinic in Kalispell, Montana, and this is not the first time you've been the target of violence. In October of 94, the clinic, which was at a different location, was firebombed. The front of the building was destroyed, forcing the clinic to close for 5 months. But this time around, the violence was so bad, the vandalism was so bad, that you had to close the clinic. So talk about what happened exactly.
This time?
Yes,
you mean?
This time. Yeah.
So this is in 94, it was a man who was not from Montana and had vandalized three abortion clinics. At this time, it was a local person. It's my own family practice clinic. And I had just moved to a new location, and that's another complicated story. But and I had remodeled the whole place. It was 3 weeks in. Hadn't gotten the total security system up. It was actually the man I had talked to Monday before the vandal came Monday night. He was going to finish it on Tuesday. It was a new system, and he had to kind of know how it worked. And then timing is everything, so it was too late. The vandal broke in through the back door and meticulously destroyed absolutely every possible thing in the clinic. 3 weeks after I had remodeled it, and it was really lovely, and we were all pretty proud of it. He also went down to the basement and destroyed both the heating and the plumbing. He broke all my pictures, he stabbed holes in them, and he did the same with my personal photos of my family and my year-old grandson. Was definitely an attack on me.
you've been performing healthcare services for 38 years. What was your reaction when you walked into the clinic and saw all of this?
Those kinds of reactions take a long time to really process. I mean, you go through all these different stages, but I guess I foolishly thought that even though there was controversy in the community, that we were respecting each other. And I didn't expect this. I mean, if I had expected it, I probably would have, been more vigilant about the security system. But I wasn't worried about it. I've been in the other place for 6.5 years, and people were praying outside, but everybody knew me. And I just felt foolishly, I think, safe.
Give us a sense of what are people vehemently anti-choice in your area? I mean, what is it like in Montana?
Montana is the fourth largest state in the union, and we have interestingly, very liberal constitution, which is slowly eroding now. But it afforded me the ability to do abortions at all. I'm one of very few non-physicians that do them, and I went through a very big legislative battle. That was another battle I did to get. In 97, it was passed. But there are maybe a growing very close-minded group of people, particularly in the Flathead Valley, which is the valley that I live in. It's curious because we have a Democratic governor, but we have a Republican legislature. They're kind of very independent-minded people. But the Flathead Valley is kind of looked at as the sort of more right-wing valley, I guess, or county of Montana.
And how many women do you serve at the All Families Clinic, Healthcare Clinic in Kalispell?
As far as abortion services goes, again, I'm a family practice PA, and I see young children, I see elderly, I've people that I've taken care of their families for 38 years. Okay. We do about between 200 and 250 abortions a year.
And so where will those people have to go now, the older people, the families?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, right now, I haven't made a decision as to what I'm going to do. And I have people that, we're a small community. I have people that greet me at the store and in the restaurants. And the young woman the other day started crying, who am I going to go to? And I just visited with a patient today, and she had tears in her eyes and said, if you need not to practice, I understand, but who am I going to go to? So that's really the hardest part of this for me. But all of it's hard for me. But I don't feel safe, and I don't know what I'm going to do.
Mm. That is Susan Cahill. She is a physician assistant and the owners of the All Families Healthcare Clinic in Kalispell, Montana. Last week, the clinic was brutally vandalized. And as Susan said, everything was destroyed. The medical equipment, every glass object, knives were stabbed into photos. And so the clinic is now closed. We're also joined by Lindsay Scheibel. She runs Fund Texas Women, a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. And Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a website that provides news and commentary on sexual and reproductive health. And Jody, we really wanted to do the show today to really connect all the dots between the laws that are passing, the clinics that are being vandalized. Talk about how common it is for clinics to face this kind of vandalism and violence.
Well, it's unfortunately all too common. There's a spectrum of sort of harassing and violent behavior at clinics that runs from the so-called sidewalk counselors, which really are people who are there intentionally to dissuade women from getting health care and who are kind of in their face all the time and who may or may not pose a threatening presence in the immediate moment to people. Then there are those places where clinic protesters are, in fact, immediately threatening, like in Pennsylvania, where one of the clinic providers was consistently threatened by a man who would whisper things to her like, you know, I have a knife in my pocket and that kind of thing as she was going in the door. And so there's kind of like a spectrum of what I would call, you know, semi-violent and actual outright violent behavior. And clinics around the country have faced vandalism. They have faced outright bombings. We've had providers killed. You know, most recently, Dr. Tiller, in I think it was 2010. I may be off by a year, but you know, this is part. This is not an aberration. This is part of a kind of continuum of effort to deny women health care, from the laws and policies that in themselves diminish women by assuming they don't have the capacity to make health care judgments or moral judgments for themselves, to the outright attacks on providers like Susan, who are serving their communities for many, many years, or the legal attacks on clinics like those in the Rio Grande Valley that have just closed.
Well, and then when we talk about laws, the Guttmacher Institute always comes out with their studies every year, and they found that there have been that more state abortion restrictions were enacted in the last 3 years than in the entire previous decade.
Yes. So we've seen, you know, this kind of approach in every state legislature, even in cases where, let's say, for example, South Dakota and Mississippi, two states where you might assume that, okay, these are really conservative states, but when the restrictions that were proposed went on the ballot initiative, people resoundingly voted them down, because people actually do not want to be interfering in the private decisions of their friends and neighbors. What happened in those states? The legislatures turned around and passed the laws anyway. How can that happen? Mm. Well, you have Michael New, who's a prominent pro-life, you know, anti-choice advocate, writing in the National Review online that anti-choice laws, quote-unquote, cannot stand the test of democracy. And that's exactly right. They can't. So you have to have legislators that are being, you know, paid by what is increasingly, obviously, dark money to really promote a sort of seamless conservative agenda that includes eroding women's rights. It's not limited to that, but it includes it. And it's anti-democratic, and it's anti-public health, and it's certainly anti-women's rights.
And we've talked about this any time we do a show on this issue, Jody. Unfortunately, it doesn't get much mention in the national media. But like you said, when you take these issues to the voters anywhere in the most conservative parts of the country, they almost always lose. It's like 90%. But, as you said, when politicians embrace them, they almost always pass. So why doesn't that part of it get more attention? Because that's a really important point to make.
You know, I think it's really critical that we recognize that a lot of the media right now is, I hate to sound sort of, you know, pedestrian about it, but it's corporatized. It's largely reflective of the opinions and sort of, you know, talking heads that are largely male, largely white, and they tend to sort of take at face value both what conservatives tell them and this notion that they have to be, quote-unquote, balanced. So even if being balanced means putting on someone who's a medical professional talking about medical facts and someone who's actually spewing outright lies and disproven medical science, they will do that. So the media has actually played what I think is a really dangerous role in getting us to this point where it reports on things in an extremely sanitized way, but yet at the same time gives cover to what is in effect a very violent movement.
We've noticed that the clinic closures have received a lot of attention, but very few reports bother to mention that there have been more abortion restrictions enacted in the last 3 years than in the entire previous decade. And Lindsay, it was kind of shocking to read the article in the New York Times about what's happening in Texas. In 2011, there were 44 facilities that performed abortions and other crucial services. And when the new restrictions are fully implemented in September, that number is expected to drop to just 6. So 44 clinics in 2011 and just 6 in 2014. And you were very active in trying to fight these laws. Can you tell us what exactly passed in Texas?
So in Texas, we have never really had the greatest abortion scene in terms of rights for women. And I do want to point out that even before HB2 was passed last year, there have been family planning cuts and other kinds of cuts for years. But what has happened is that all of the worst ideas of the anti-choice movement have been packaged together in one bill called HB2. And it has been enacted in a couple of stages, but right now we're in the middle of two. And the final stage of HB2, which goes in effect this September, as you mentioned, will result in the closure of almost all of the clinics in the state. But even before we get to that point, right, right now in Texas, the few abortions clinics that we do have right now are still concentrated in just a couple of areas. So we may have 24 abortion clinics, but they're only located in maybe five or six cities. And for Texas, a huge state with a huge rural population, that makes abortion almost inaccessible for much of the population already, even as we speak. And that's what we do at Fund Texas Women, is we try and get these people who live in the rural areas that are not accessible to their closest clinic, whether that be 10-hour drive away.
Wow, so 10 hours for some women.
Sometimes, yes.
You know, the other issue that, or the other side of this that's often missing is just how this affects people personally. You rarely hear personal stories in the media. So after you founded this group, Fund Texas Women, what kind of response did you get, and who are you hearing from now? Can you tell us a few stories?
Sure. So we have received about 200 calls since we opened our hotline in November, and of those 200 calls, we've funded about 37 trips. So that means 37 different women who we've sent to their closest clinic. Sometimes we pay for hotels and sometimes bus tickets, plane tickets, things like that. And from these women, what we hear is that the work that Fund Texas Women is doing is directly related to their empowerment. So in other words, women call us lost, and when we tell them that we can help them by paying for some part of their transportation, they feel like they have the ability to take control over their own choices. So, for example, there was a woman that we helped who goes by the name of Juliana, and she had a pregnancy that she intended to follow through with, but at her 20-week ultrasound, she found out that her fetus had so many abnormalities that it wouldn't survive birth. But by the time she had her ultrasound, she was already past the 20-week gestational age limit that has been enacted by HB2 in Texas. So it would have been illegal for her to get an abortion in Texas at that point. So we helped Juliana by flying her to New Mexico, which ironically is right next door and doesn't have a legal limit on gestational age for abortions. But we were able to raise the money to fly both her and her husband to a clinic that gave her a procedure lasting a week long.
That is Lindsay Scheibel. She is a 20-year-old student at the University of Texas at Austin and the founder of Fund Texas Women, a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. In Texas, there were 44 facilities that performed abortions and other crucial services in 2011. When the new law is fully implemented in September, that number is expected to drop to just six. We're also joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a publication providing news and analysis on these issues, and we're joined by Susan Cahill, physician's assistant and the owner of All Families Healthcare, a clinic in Kalispell, Montana, one of just four clinics that was recently forced to close because of brutal vandalism. And today we are talking about what's happening on the front lines of the fight for abortion. We are seeing so many laws passed across the country. There have been more laws passed to restrict abortion in the last 3 years than in the last decade. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on what we're facing right now? What should the response be? What is in store for the future of reproductive rights? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Susan, again, you've been performing healthcare services for 38 years. When you step back and look at what we're currently facing right now, how do you make sense of how we got here?
Oh, that's a really big question.
I know. I mean, we try to answer that every time we do a show about this, and I know it's
It makes me think of a couple of things. One is the comments I think that I made to somebody for all the talking that I've been doing the past couple of weeks was that those of us who are still doing this remember when it was illegal. I mean, I was born in 1950, and I remember there was a joke, and I think back on this, I don't know why, when I was young, and about sort of this thing, sort of this woman is in the is delivering a baby, and she says something, I can't remember the joke now, who was she speaking to? And nobody knew who she was speaking to because she identified that person as a woman, and it ends up she was speaking to her doctor. But at that point, nobody even thought about females in the medical field being doctors. Mm. I mean, that's what I grew up with. and it's when I heard that, and I just sort of struck me, I think that it was the beginning of my understanding that women are disregarded. And my husband just wrote a letter to a patient of his who wrote a response to the vandalism in my clinic by talking about how she's heartbroken every time an abortion is done. And he just got really mad. And he wrote back, he said, when was it that women, you know, became less important than an embryo? When was that? Hmm. And I said to him, I think actually it's always been that way. When you really think about the misogyny of our society. And we had Roe v. Wade passed at a time when the physician that I was that I worked with and who taught me abortion care, when he saw in New York City, he saw women die every day of illegal abortions. And when I went to PA school from 74 to 76, Roe v. Wade was passed in 73, I was trained to do abortions. They were all over the country, which is the way it should be. Now you have to ask for training, and it is almost impossible to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing this, and it seemed like finally we started realizing that women and families, I don't want to just say women and families need to be able to control their reproduction and the sizes of their family so they can live the way they choose to in, you know, And from the moment we got that ability, somebody said, "Uh-oh," and they started eroding it. And so I think it's been happening always.
That is Susan Cahill. She's physician's assistant and owner of All Families Healthcare in Kalispell, Montana. She had no choice but to shut down her clinic. It's one of four in the state of Montana because it was brutally vandalized. And you can read an article that Susan wrote about what happened at yourcallradio.org. Today we're talking about what's happening on the front lines of the abortion fight. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this.
Take part in today's conversation. You can join us toll-free. The number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. If you're a first-time caller, let us know. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can go to the website, yourcallradio.org, and either leave a message, or you can write an email and send it to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, just 30 minutes away, live from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will have a conversation with public health advocate Nicholas Freudenberg about his new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He argues that decisions made by six industries, food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto, have a greater impact on today's health than the decisions made by scientists and policymakers. So we'll talk about how corporations set the agenda for public health. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about what is happening on the front lines of the abortion fight. And more state abortion restrictions were enacted in the last 3 years than in the entire previous decade. And we're talking about that with Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a website providing news and commentary on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. Lindsay Scheibel is a 20-year-old student at the University of Texas at Austin, founder of Fund Texas Women. It's a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. And we're joined by Susan Cahill, a physician assistant and the owner of All Families Healthcare, a clinic in Kalispell, Montana, one of four in the state, forced to shut down last week because of brutal vandalism. And if you'd like to join us, we have full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. What questions and comments do you have about what we're currently facing in this country when it comes to safe and legal access to abortion and other crucial health care services? What is in store for the future of reproductive rights, and what should the response to all of this be? 866-798-8255. If you work for a group that works on these issues, what are the conversations you're having about how to respond? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Michelle in Alameda. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. So I just want to say really quickly, thank you for having this discussion and creating this forum. One of the questions that I have is how can we actually kind of bridge the gap between people who are very concerned, who have directly some kind of experience with what's happening with reproductive services for women and feel compelled to protect them or try to protect them, and people who just don't see that as an important issue for a national discussion. I feel like one of the things that's really happening that's working against us is kind of the nature of being either a practitioner or a customer of reproductive services is that it's so private and personal, and there's this stigma attached to it. I've heard a lot of statistics, and I think one that I hear often is that something like 80 to 90% of the services have nothing to do with abortion. They're basically life planning, family planning, sexual education services, but that just doesn't seem to be getting the cachet in terms of like those mainstream media outlets. But those are the people that we want to talk to and reach, and I'm trying to figure out, I guess my question for myself as well as the audience is, how can we find that lingua franca? Because what is going down is so serious and it affects so many women, but because of the nature of being a woman and having wanting to have that service or using that service, it's like we're kind of self-censoring and self-silenced, you know, in terms of like having a discussion at a dinner. You don't necessarily sit at a dinner and say, you know, hey, I've actually benefited from these services. I've had da-da-da-da-da procedures, and I think it's important that we protect those for future generations. It's just not the conversation you feel comfortable with having publicly.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. Thank you, Michelle. Jody, do you want to take that one first?
I mean, I think there's so many things. It's what you say, what the caller has suggested, is really critical, and I think there's so many things we have to be doing. If as individuals you want to think about things that you could be doing, I think what you're pointing to, the silencing, is a critical issue because part of stigma depends not only on social stigmatizing and silencing, but then self-silencing, like women have done forever, for example, with domestic violence until people started talking about it. So I think what we need to do and what an individual could do is to start those conversations among the people that she knows, the men and the women that that she knows, all of whom, by statistical, you know, rationale, know somebody who's had an abortion. And so start to talk about those things. Bring together people. You know, maybe sign a letter to the editor jointly with however many people you can. Write an op-ed. Go to your congressperson's office and talk to them about this issue. We as individuals and the community of groups that work on these issues have to be more visible. We have to be more focused on a proactive strategy of reclaiming our rights rather than simply reacting. And that will only start when we start being public about this issue and start letting go of the fear. Because, you know, it's really dependent on fear and stigma that we're all separated from each other.
And, Lindsay, what would you add to that?
I mean, would just say that, in my experience, you can't do this kind of work without feeling every story that you hear, and it's the stories that have that power. And on our hotline, we get calls from women all the time who have their own unique individual situations, but if there were only a way for us to connect them to one another, then it would be a source of great power. When I spoke about Juliana earlier, the woman that we helped, what she told us is, I don't mind sharing the story because it's real. I've learned that the more I talk about it, the better I feel about it. I didn't want to regret not having her, so that's why I talk. And these are the kinds of stories that we really try and spread as far as we can, because these women are everywhere. They're us and they're our friends. And as long as we are willing to share our stories, then we'll be able to connect in that way. And I think that that's just what's missing. The hard part, though, is that the stigma is real, and it's not just some sort of nebulous shame, but at least in Texas, there are real and material consequences for sharing those stories. So I do think there needs to be some sort of safe space created for these kinds of stories to be shared, but I do think that it's extremely important. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling, Michelle. Let's go next to Denise in San Francisco. Hi, Denise. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I want to talk about the pressure to have an abortion, which I experienced when I was out of hospital, unmarried, and became pregnant in 1987. The father-to-be was a graduate student. He threatened to commit suicide if I had a baby. The prescription I was on is toxic to unborn, so the OBGYN told me that it was medically indicated to stop the pregnancy. Well, how convenient, because if I delivered a child that was damaged from this toxic drug I was given without informed consent, then, I would have a cause of action against her colleague. So, having an abortion, then there's a death of a child, which I did not get any pathology reports. I was not given the remains for a burial. So, all the doctors were covered. The father-to-be didn't have to pay any child support. And I had been in treatment for depression, and now I had blood on my hands. And I was pressured in the family to do so because I was alone. And, I lost my job when I was in the hospital. And I find it, routinely drugs are given that are unsafe for unborn. And women are, not having planned pregnancies all the time. So I find it, extremely troubling that women are used as guinea pig for dangerous drugs and are, told now that we know how to do an abortion that we can do that. And then women have, all this guilt and suffering of not being able to have their children because they've been poisoned.
So, Denise, let me ask you, where do you stand on this issue now?
Me?
Yes.
I believe, life is precious, and that, I would love to be part of a lawsuit representing the unborn who has no voice and who loses their life in this process. And I know a father who's a bus driver, paratransit driver, whose mother of his child didn't want to be a mom, and he said, well, just that's what I will be the single father.
Well,
he is the happiest single father you could ever meet, and she meant it. She didn't want anything to do with his baby, but at least she didn't take it.
Well, thank you. I'm sorry for the experience you had. Susan, can you talk about this? Because you've said that over the years there have been so many medical advances that this procedure has never been safer today.
Right. Denise, are you still on the line?
No, she dropped.
Okay. That woman was not speaking about the safety of abortion. So she was speaking about her troubled past. So and this is part of, unfortunately, what women buy into. But abortions, when I learned to do them, they've been advanced so incredibly from the time that I started learning them, and we were learning them when Dr. Armstrong and I started doing them right after Roe. we got, he was a fabulous physician, and there were times when we learned by just finding ourselves into places that we didn't have been before with patients. We didn't have ultrasounds. Sometimes they end up being farther along than we knew. Now we have ultrasounds. Now we have medication abortions. Now we have pregnancy tests that tell women that they're pregnant even before they've missed their period. I mean, we have a little manual vacuum aspiration thing. It's such an easy procedure, particularly in the first trimester, that it's safer than a shot of penicillin. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, safer than having your tonsils removed for sure. It's a very safe procedure. And I don't know anybody who does good abortion care that forces any woman to do something that they don't want. And, in fact, we go overboard. We go overboard to make sure that women feel clear about their decision. All of us. We have consent forms up the yin-yang over that, and we have counselors, and, you know, I have an MSW, so I do all of that myself, and I also don't believe that women should be, if you ask them too many questions, it's almost making us try to feel, are you sure you want to do this, like you don't trust your own judgment? We're grown women, for goodness sake. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't believe that we should overdo that, but I also know that we make sure that women feel as clear as they can. And I have I have ongoing counseling people in the community that I can refer to if I feel that women need that. So that those kinds of things, life is complex, and people need choices. I mean, that's the bottom line here. We have enough struggle, and we have worked so hard to make this procedure as safe as possible.
That is Susan Cahill, a physician assistant and owner of All Families Healthcare, a clinic in Kalispell, Montana, one of four in the state that was forced to close last week after being brutally vandalized. We're also joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a website providing news and analysis on sexual and reproductive health and justice issues. And Lindsay Scheibel is a 20-year-old student at the University of Texas at Austin, founder of Fund Texas Women, a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. Texas now has 24 clinics. It had 44 in 2011. And when a new law goes into effect in September, that number is expected to drop to just 6. And if you'd like to join us, we still have full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thank you again, Denise, for calling. Let's go next to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Just a couple quick questions, more legal. At Roe v. Wade, at what point do the exceptions eat up the rule legally? It seems like women are being discriminated against. And in the famous case that went before the Supreme Court in the 1800s, the Yick Wo case, they said that the first time ever that a law, so for instance, these state laws they're passing that appear gender or race neutral or free of bias on their face, but if they're applied in a discriminatory fashion, then they're illegal. So here we have Roe v. Wade being hollowed out, and it's only being applied against women. All these clinics are against women. So don't we have a constitutional argument here that women's rights, women are being denied equal protection under the law for access to health services?
Jody, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I do, actually. You are absolutely right, and this is something I've been saying recently in public speaking and in meeting with people, because I think that there's a sort of, you know, one level of thinking is, well, you know, there's all these restrictions, but we still have Roe v. Wade. Well, the fact of the matter is that Roe v. Wade is basically dead. For the women of the Rio Grande Valley, who are predominantly low-income, may not have transportation, are 10 hours away from a clinic, as you just heard, Roe v. Wade does not exist. They may have, on paper, some sort of legal right, but if you don't have access to a clinic, you don't have a right. And so I think that this is the strategy of the fanatical anti-choice movement, which is to litter the landscape with so many restrictions. You know, one day they'll talk about 20-week abortion bans, and the next day they are trying to ban early medication abortion, which is safer than safe. I mean, so, you know, it's really profoundly important that we understand that all of these restrictions are, in fact, taking away the effective right for women to exercise judgment about their health, their families, and their ability to bear and raise a child. And the other thing I'd like to say, and it pertains to the earlier caller's comment, I think it's terrible if anyone is ever coerced into any medical procedure anywhere at any time. Terrible. However, that being said, the individual instance in the 1980s of this woman's case is not really tantamount to the wealth of public health evidence that we have that when abortion is not safe and available, legally and otherwise, women die. Mm-hmm. Across the entire globe, you know, complications of unsafe abortion are leading causes of death in women. So we are not talking in this country about eliminating abortion. We are talking about eliminating safe abortion because women will continue to terminate pregnancies. They will do so through any means possible. Mm-hmm. And we have to understand the public health toll that will take not only on women but on their families, because we also know from public health data from throughout the world and through 50 years that safe abortion services are correlated with higher rates of infant and maternal survival, because women can choose when and whether to have children, when they can afford them, and when they're able to parent. So these are really critical issues, not only at an individual rights level, but also at a public health and social level.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because according to the World Health Organization, over 21 million women experience an unsafe abortion every year around the globe. 47,000 die. Most of these unsafe abortions happen in Africa and South America, where abortion is illegal. And Lindsay, in that New York Times article, the reporter interviewed a number of women in Texas who said that rather than drive 4 to 10 hours, they're actually thinking about going to Mexico to get a pill to end their pregnancy. And they would do this on their own. So is this something that people are talking about in Texas? Because what happens if they get a bad pill and something bad happens?
Well, people are not just talking about it in Texas. People are doing
it. Yeah.
And what happens is that with so few options, you take the one that's available to you. Even going across the border to Mexico to get these pills illegally is an option that is only available for those whose immigration status allows them to traverse borders freely. There's so many constraints on women who are trying to get the health care they need that it's forcing women into these dangerous situations. And that's actually what I wanted to say a little earlier, is that I do want to push back a little bit on this question of choice, right? That even at the point where a woman is able to get into the abortion clinic and give her consent, this doesn't take into account the fact that many of our callers express the feeling that they had to get an abortion, right? Because maybe due to poverty or due to their particular circumstance, that this was the only option that was available to them. And that, I think, is important to remember when we're talking about restrictions on abortion, that sometimes there are also a lot of restrictions on parenting that make it harder for people to feel like they can freely have a child. The restrictions on Roe v. Wade started as soon as the Hyde Amendment passed in 1976, and that is a long history where abortions cannot be funded by the federal government, right? That takes many women in poverty out of consideration for Medicaid funding for their abortions, making abortion inaccessible from that point. So my point is that it's not always as simple as looking at these restrictions in the last decade, but rather the history of abortion access being something that is always a privilege. And that is the true unfortunate part of all of this.
What is the status of accessing birth control in Texas?
Well, you have to pay for it, because the Texas legislature eroded family planning funding so much that the clinics that used to be able to provide them cheaply or for free are seriously struggling now and are few and far between. I talked to a caller who lived in Odessa, Texas, and she said that she was going to get an IUD from her local clinic for a, you know, a reduced rate, but then that clinic had to close, and so now she got an unintended pregnancy and needed to have an abortion. So these relationships are all very closely related to each other in Texas.
Lindsay, I just want to ask you quickly. You're 20 years old, and you're very obviously so passionate about this issue. There's often a criticism of young people, right, because you grew up with safe and legal access to abortion, hopefully birth control, some sex ed, maybe not, depending on where you live. But there's criticism of the younger generation that they just didn't know what it was like when it was illegal and therefore aren't as active as they should be. What are your thoughts on that? And are your friends, do that your friends really care about this issue?
Well, first of all, I'm from Texas, and there's no such thing as sex ed here. But
not at all?
Well, not in public schools. The quality of sex ed is only abstinence-only education. That's all we're allowed to learn in public schools in Texas. Hmm. And but anyway, young people in Texas are awake and alive. I think that last summer definitely proved that. Here in Austin, which is the capital of Texas, but also where the flagship State University is located, lots of college students and people younger than that were showing up at the Capitol last summer, where I saw them holding signs. In fact, a woman in Austin who owns a bed and breakfast was telling me that her 14-year-old daughter made a sign that said, "Jesus is not a dick, so keep him out of my vagina." And this, I think, points to the radicalism of the youth, that they are available for this kind of action right now, but we just need to get them started.
And that is Lindsay Scheibel. She's founder of Fund Texas Women, a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. We have time for just a few more calls. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Good evening. I'd like to thank all of you for having this program. I just want to mention, about 2 weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times with the headline, "The Boys in the Bunkhouse." And it was to do with a number of men who were born to families, mostly in Texas, poor families. And these were babies that were born with brain impairment and physical problems, and because of their family's financial status, the families couldn't take care of these babies. So these men grew up, and they were taken on by a turkey processing plant, and they lived in slavery for 30 years, these men did. And as I read this article, I thought, where were the families of these men? Obviously, they couldn't deal with the handicaps. So they shipped them out, but also the community where these people lived in slavery, in shame and secrecy. And these are people who, if their mothers had had a choice, if they'd been able to perhaps end the pregnancy or use birth control, perhaps these men wouldn't have been human casualties. I mean, it's just, do you follow me?
Yeah, I read part of that, and it was horrendous. Thank you for calling. We'll put a link on the website right after the show. And I, unfortunately, I can't really ask the guests to respond to it because we only have about 30 or a minute left. But I do, we were actually thinking about maybe doing something on that. So thanks for calling. Jody, just final thoughts. Where do you see this going? And every time you're on, we always ask you what the response should be. But how do you answer that question today?
Well, I mean, in brief, expanding on what I said earlier, I think that it's incumbent upon every woman and man in this country who believes in basic human rights and the right to bodily integrity and control of your own body to start to step up and to really hold accountable these legislators and this movement that is threatening women's lives. And that's, you know, that's the end result of it. It's going to take a lot. I'm going to be doing some writing on what I think needs to be done, actually. But I think that we are at a pivot point where people are beginning to realize it's gone beyond any sort of sanity to a process of truly eliminating public health care for women.
Susan Cahill, final thoughts, about 30 seconds.
We just have to keep talking about it in bigger and bigger circles, and the young people in Texas need to spread out the word to the young people in other places, I think, that aren't suffering as much as Texas is suffering.
Mm.
And because they're all going to suffer. And, you know, these stories, they're human stories. They're part the men, these men, and Denise who called up, they're human stories. But if we don't have legal access to safe abortion, those stories will be so much bigger.
Susan Cahill is a physician assistant and the owner of All Families Healthcare, one of four clinics in Montana. It's located in Kalispell. It was forced to close after being brutally vandalized last week. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of RH Reality Check, a website that focuses on these issues. And Lindsay Scheibel is the founder of Fund Texas Women, a nonprofit that pays travel expenses to help Texas women get abortions in and out of the state. There were 44 facilities that performed abortions in 2011. In September, that number is expected to drop to just six clinics in Texas. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Thank you, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How are corporations setting the agenda for public health? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Nicholas Freudenberg about his new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He argues that decisions made by six industries, food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto, have a greater impact on today's health than the decisions made by scientists and policymakers. So how can we restore the balance between corporations and government and profit and public health? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.